Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, June 8th. I'm Ray Graff. It's our science forum today, and we welcome back three brilliant minds to answer your science questions. 800-348-2551 is the number. 800-348-2551. Now, I will remind you that we are awaiting word, some words, from President Trump's outside attorney, Mark Kasowitz. They should be happening any minute now, and we will break live for coverage of that. He'll be responding to today's Senate testimony by former FBI Director James Comey. So stand by for that. Stand by also for the Science Forum. And the number is 800-348-2551. I know it's very confusing, but hang with us and we'll all work it out together. Well, hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Today we reconvene the Science Forum, and this is always a fun time and an interesting time to be listening to the radio. The number to call is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. If you have a science question, the phones look like they're all discombobulated at the moment. So I know our engineers will take a look at that. They're looking at that. And you can email. Sure, why not? voxpop@wamc.org. voxpop@wamc.org. Before we introduce the panel of scientists today, I will tell you that we're waiting for a press conference by President Trump's outside attorney, Mark Kasowitz, who will be responding to some of the testimony today by former FBI Director James Comey. We will hope to take you live coverage of that. It should have started 40 minutes ago. So let's meet our panel. Scientists, sign in, please.
Ed Stander, SUNY Cobl Skill, astronomy, geology, and no biology.
I'm Jim Pickett. I'm an organic chemist.
Bring on the biology. It's Barbara Brobitz.
Oh, you're back.
Biochemist.
Nice.
I was gone once.
Well, it's nice to have you back.
We have lots of questions for you, though.
Oh, that's good.
Again, the number to call is 800-348-2551, or if that doesn't work, the email address is voxpop@wamc.org, or if you're just waiting to hear comments from President Trump's attorney, Mark Kasowitz, well, you're in luck because they'll be coming probably just about as we begin the show. Well, scientists, today happens to be World Oceans Day. What's that?
I think it's a UN-sponsored thing to put attention on the world's oceans.
And not just that they're there, but that they are in jeopardy from things like global climate change and heating. One of the other issues with the oceans that we predict will happen from global climate change is ocean acidification. This sounds much more complicated than it really is, but as you put more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, the carbon dioxide dissolves when it's in contact with water. We got a lot of water in the oceans. And at that surface, when you add more CO2 into water, it makes carbonic acid, and that lowers the pH of the oceans. So why do you care?
Why do I care?
Yeah, because if you're a shellfish, your exoskeleton is pH dependent, and you will thin out and possibly not survive if ocean acidification continues.
Let's say 100 million years ago, was the pH the same in the ocean?
No. In fact, we can look at sedimentary rock or sedimentation and look at the thickness and thinness of these exoskeletons of rotifers, which are these really, really small animals, or actually at the ancestors of crabs and lobsters as we know them today, or clams, and then be able to project what the CO2 levels were in the atmosphere. So they're actually a good fossil barometer for what used to be.
Yeah, and for example, during the time of the dinosaurs, the CO2 was apparently around 100 times higher than it is now, which means it was a lot warmer.
And why was that?
Well, because there were a lot more volcanic activity going on. The oceans, there was no ice, for example, up at the North and South Poles, it was so warm. In fact, we have examples of fossils and such.
Now, wouldn't volcanic activity of that scale also provide some sort of a cooling, nuclear winter kind of thing?
It depends on what kind of volcanic activity. If it's what's called a stratovolcano, they produce a lot of ash, and that could do that. But other types of volcanoes, for example, the Hawaiian type, the shield volcanoes, produce lots of lava and CO2, but no ash.
And the ash would settle out on a relatively short time scale compared with how long the CO2 will last.
Right. The only way CO2 is really removed from the atmosphere is either a slow geologic process that is dissolving in the oceans, getting bound up in those biology things we talked about, and then having them die and settle to the bottom and become rock.
Limestone.
Right. Limestone over long, long periods of time. Or we have the photosynthesis, respiration, yin-yang that goes on now.
So more plants.
Plants, yeah.
Bigger and more of them?
And more efficient, because if you think of ancient history, our blue-green algae, the predecessors of today's, we still have blue-green algae today, they're not as efficient in their photosynthesis as higher plants are.
Right, and it also depends a lot on how fast subduction was going on in the oceans, if you have plate tectonics, because what happens there is that the limestone that's all on the bottom, effectively the fossilized CO2, goes down the tubes, melts, comes out of volcanoes. So the faster plate tectonics occurs, the more CO2 there is in the atmosphere. Mm.
Tell me about the supervolcanoes. They frighten me and they keep me awake at night.
There's won't feel a thing, Ray. Really won't.
Will we, in fact, we won't be blown to smithereens here if the one out west goes, but we'll die a slow death, yeah?
Well, the Midwest will get covered by one heck of a lot of...
How much?
Well, they figure, let's see, Yellowstone, which is really the major supervolcano on the North American continent, produced... what was it? It covered up effectively the entire Midwest and north part of the United States. And we're talking there about thousands of feet of ash.
Really?
Yeah.
Thousands of feet?
Oh, yeah. In the area of the volcano and decreasing as you went away from it. And that's a lot of ash to get a plant through.
When's the last time that we reckon the supervolcano blew its stack?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure when that was. But it was about 10,000-15,000 years ago.
That's fairly recent.
But we're overdue. According to the geologic clock, our alarm clock already went off, and we're overdue.
Well, if you look at we now have satellites, of course, out in space, and you can actually see how the land around Yellowstone is rising or falling, depending on what magma's doing, and it's rising. So
at some point, like a Jiffy Pop popcorn on a hot plate, it'll pop.
All you need is a little knife on the top, and you're done for.
Ooh. How about that? Our number here is 800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum today. And again, we are awaiting a press conference by President Trump's outside attorney, Mark Kasowitz, and we will carry that live in theory.
That was cool. We went from oceans to volcanoes, just like that.
It's all related.
Where to next?
Well, can I put in a plug for SUNY Cobleskill?
Oh, I suppose.
I guess.
I have time.
I wanted to let everybody know that we have a series of camps for summer coming up.
Oh, really?
So if you want a different kind of camp, you know, that doesn't necessarily require black flies, you may want to consider our Secret Agent STEM Camp, which runs from July 10th to the 14th. Or from July 17th to 21st, you can Google SUNY Cobleskill Summer Camps, and it will show up.
What age bracket are we talking about
here?
Yeah,
the age bracket are from second grade up to seventh grade.
Oh, this is terrific.
So it's terrific for students who have an interest that don't necessarily know what they want to do. I'm sure they're going to limit the dead body exposure for those second graders. But, you know, we can only hope that they'll get a true experience without the carnage.
And Barbara Brabbitz is guaranteeing no black flies. In Cobleskill.
I would say no black flies, but I won't say that for mosquitoes. So,
fair enough.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Well, our number is 800-348-2551. We may or may not be having trouble with the phones here today. I see a call coming in, and I'm sure we'll get to that call right about the time President Trump's attorney speaks. It's we're winging it today.
Yeah. Can I tell you about the 3D camp we got going on?
Absolutely.
We have a 3D printing camp. So it's a CAD design / 3D printing camp, and that goes on at the end of July. And those are for slightly older students. Those are middle school and high schoolers, so from 7th grade to 10th grade. And that is July 31st through August 4th. And again, it's a day camp, but... you get a T-shirt, you get camp, you get to take home your 3D images that you make, and you get to eat a good lunch.
The 3D printers blow my mind.
It's actually a 4D printer because it takes time to make the prints.
Oh, it does. Uh-huh. A lot of time, actually.
They're very cool, though, and they have them in a lot of the high schools now. And It's amazing. I would never have been able to think of something like this even 20 years ago.
Well, it's a great toy, but it's a terrific tool for science, too. I have a student of mine who did a project this semester. We have a taxidermy studio. So as part of our fisheries and wildlife major for college students, we have this taxidermy museum. And the unfortunate thing is you have to get the brain material out of the skull.
Yeah,
and that can be very difficult. There's a lot of nooks and crannies.
Yeah.
So what happens is if you don't get that out, it draws bugs. And so often what happens in any taxidermy is the head itself ends up being attacked by bugs over time, so your specimen deteriorates and it's not museum quality anymore. So what she did is she had a great idea. Why don't I just get an exact replica of the skull of the animal that we're stuffing and use that instead? So she 3D printed. She first took visual images in three dimensions of the skull of the birds that she did, and then had the 3D printers make them and stuck the plastic skull in instead of the real skull.
How many images would you need to take?
You can actually 3D image. You put it on a little stand, a little tiny stand, and then you have specialty cameras, which we have at the college, to be able to take that and render it into three dimensions. It's really quite standard equipment these days.
Now, is that considered fair play in taxidermy?
I think actually it's an advantage in taxidermy.
Is there a taxidermy code of ethics?
Well, I would expect so.
That is a question.
Yeah.
Oy, I hope so. Yeah. But anyway, so she's presented this paper at a conference, and she's going to a national meeting to present it as well.
That is very cool. Well, I tell you what, let's take a break, and we'll try to get some underwriting in here, and then we'll come back and take some calls, and then we'll hear an attorney. It's the Science Forum. We'll be back.
Support comes from the Department of Theater Arts at SUNY New Paltz, an undergraduate theater program in liberal arts with concentrations in design and technology, theater studies, and performance. newpaltz.edu/theatre. Vermont Coffee Company, offering slow-roasted organic coffee in the brown paper bag at local grocery stores. Vermont Coffee Company, coffee roasted for friends. The Henyon Bakery, Amherst, since 1993, offering hearth-baked whole grain breads, pastries, birthday, wedding, and special occasion cakes, as well as gluten-free offerings. HenyonBakery.com. Blue Sky Bicycles, Saratoga Springs, New York, now offering electric bikes to the Capital Region, featuring pedal assist bikes with test rides available. BlueSkyBicycles.com. And the New York Military Academy, Cornwall, a co-ed college preparatory boarding school focusing on academics, character, and athletics. Open house on Sunday, June 11th from 11 to 1. NYMA.org.
Any of our scientists tell me who was playing sax?
Oh, nope. Sorry, I wasn't listening.
You weren't listening?
Points off. We were talking.
Right, you know what? You may know science. You don't know jazz. That's Sonny Rollins, so no points awarded. It's the Science Forum here on Vox Pop, and boy, what fun we're having awaiting the Trump attorney, who will be carrying live, and I'm sure that you'll be riveted by that. In the meantime, Barbara Brabitz is here, Jim Pickett, and Ed Stander. They are the scientists, and they will answer your questions. Our number is 800-348-2551. We have an email here, but let's go to Roger in Gloversville. Roger, you're on.
Greetings. Since you were talking about schools, do you know of any science programs in the area called Family Science?
Family Science. Is that for homeschoolers?
No, it's out of Portland, Oregon. It's similar to Family Math, which is out of Berkeley.
I'm not familiar with it, but I can tell you there are scores of camps. There's even the Times Union in previous years, I haven't looked this year, has collected summer camps and other camp experiences on their website. That's a local Albany paper. And so if you're in the listening area and you're looking for summer camps in your area, I would first check with your local publications to find out what's available.
And there are, in terms of family science, there's actually a number of websites which you can do at home and get your kids involved, for example, in cooking and such.
Right.
Which is, I think, is one of those is what it is.
Did you have another question, Roger? Because the synopsis
my question was about soda in two liter bottles.
Oh.
If I want to get it cold as quickly as possible, and I go to put it in the freezer, is it better to take the pressure off by opening it, or is it better to have the pressure it's pressurized,
which is the way a
2 liter bottle comes?
This is an important question.
This is good.
I don't think it's going to make much difference.
No, the expansion and contraction is not from the gas, but rather from the liquid. As water cools and as water changes temperature, density fluctuates. And that's really the phenomenon that if you leave your beer on the porch in the dead of winter, it'll blow the bottoms and tops off the beer can. It's really the liquid expanding. It's not the gas.
So it won't speed up the process in any way if you...
Actually, the bottles are designed, they're made of a polycarbonate, which is designed not to blow up, but to expand as the thing freezes.
Polyester.
Polyester.
There you go. Roger, that was a great question. Thanks. Our number is 800-348-2551. Science Forum. And this email came in from Edward in Loudonville as we await President Trump's attorney. He may or may not be speaking. Edward says, what is the odor in urine that it produces, and how does it get into the bloodstream and urine so quickly? In my case, circa 30 minutes. Well, thank you for that, Edward. The BBC claims some people can and others cannot detect this odor.
Well, it's mainly ammonia that we smell.
Yeah.
obviously... and we're programmed to stay away. There's a definite brain response to ew.
Yeah.
Not just the sight, but also the odor.
And even the emails.
Apparently. Yeah. Not even a scent-filled email. The thing about it is there's many, many different... So your kidneys end up taking waste from nitrogen, which is hard to deal with, out of your blood and convert it to... urea, which then becomes urine when it goes into liquid form. And your kidney's sole job is to burn energy in order to do that onerous task. So if you eat a lot of protein or you have a problem with absorbing protein in your digestive system, then you will create a more noxious urine.
And what about asparagus then? Why is it that some people produce an asparagus urine, which is quite noxious?
It's the same digestive process, but there are certain enzymes that you have the ability to make or not make. So you can actually genetically test someone to see if they'll make nasty asparagus smell or not. In fact, 23andMe, it's one of their metabolic characterization profile is the asparagus smell, which is not really what my doctor needs to know, but for $99.99, you can find that out. Animals beyond humans use urine as a marker of gender and also species. So you walk your dog down the road in suburbia and may stop and smell, and they can tell gender by that smell. Huh. So the hormones of estrogen and testosterone and other associated pheromones are as part of the urine because it's used as a social marker.
And do you think it's true that big dogs effectively urinate over the top of small dogs' urine smell to cover a larger territory?
I think it's known that male dogs will typically try to overcome the other pheromone there if it's in order to say, hey, look at me, instead of look at this potential mate that might be leaving a marker.
Huh.
At the same time, if a female pees there, then the male will mark on top of that to say, she's mine, guys. So,
what about the second part of Edward's question? And I can't verify what the BBC reported, but he says the BBC claims some people can and others cannot detect the odor. Is that true? Is that possible?
I don't know about the smell. The smell of ammonia is so strong. I don't know about the inability to smell ammonia. I do know about the asparagus generation smell.
So. And of course, there are people who can't smell at all because they don't have the ability.
Yeah, you make a point. Our number here is 800-348-2551. 800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum. And I don't know if the phones are working, but we have some emails. And this one came in from Rick, who says, I live in a rural town with miles of gravel roads. When the road crew applies a lot of winter sand or fine gravel, after a couple of days in some places, this material forms a series of small ridges at a right angle to the right-of-way, which is commonly known as washboard. What causes this effect? And that's from Rick.
Well, two things. First thing is washboarding can be caused by just water running down the road. And what happens is the water collects enough material to form a slight dam, then it goes over the top and forms the next one. But basically, it has to do with the fact that when a first bump occurs, your tire starts to go into a series of, effectively develops a frequency, and it starts to form the second bump and the third bump and the fourth bump so that they wind up being equally spaced.
So if you have smaller tires, say like a like a 4x4, they're not going to washboard at the same frequency repetitious pattern as like a 14 or a 15 or a 16-inch wheel.
Although it also depends on the speed you're going.
Mm-hmm.
Very interesting.
In fact, you know that there's a place in San Francisco where they've washboarded the road. They put bumps on it so that as you drive over it, it plays Mozart.
Okay, my kids, we were on the highway the other day, and I showed the kids the little alert ridges and said, this is what it feels like. And one of them, smart Alex, said just that, and I didn't believe them. So that mm-hmm. is true?
Yeah, it goes, boom, 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 boom.
Wow.
You go at exactly the right speed on this one particular road in San Francisco.
That's amazing. This one came in from Hannah via email at voxpopwamc.org. I heard a radio program that interviewed people who had amputated limbs and then experienced phantom limbs. I'm curious if someone born without a limb or more, to my interest, a goat who has been disbutted and never developed their horns might have this experience. We have goats who seem to think their heads are stuck in the fence, etc., when they are not. I began to wonder if they might feel as though their non-existent horns are caught. And that's from Hannah.
So just to give the listeners a little phantom limb 101, usually what happens with phantom limb syndrome is you have a nerve that's been twanged, for lack of a better medical term, usually with acute pain, like really severe pain.
Mm-hmm.
And that at the time or just following that signal to the brain, the limb is either blocked, the pain is blocked, or the limb is amputated as a means of relieving whatever stressor was put on the limb. The problem isn't really with the nerve, it's with the brain.
I see.
And the brain never gets the all clear.
Interesting.
So since the all clear doesn't happen, the brain is continuing to ring the bell. So does that happen with dehorning? That's a great question. I don't ever know that anyone has looked at that.
Really interesting. But okay, so I'm getting word from our... okay, let's go over and we'll take a press conference from President Trump's outside attorney, Mark Kasowitz.
Personal lawyer. Contrary to numerous false press accounts leading up to today's hearing, Mr. Comey has now finally confirmed publicly what he repeatedly told President Trump privately. That is, that the president was not under investigation as part of any probe into Russian interference. The president, Mr. Comey also admitted that there is no evidence that a single vote changed as a result of any Russian interference. Mr. Comey's testimony also makes clear that the president never sought to impede the investigation into attempted Russian interference in the 2016 election. And in fact, according to Mr. Comey, the president told Mr. Comey, quote, it would be good to find out, close quote, in that investigation if there was, quote, some satellite associates of his who did something wrong, close quote. And he, President Trump, did not exclude anyone from that statement. Consistent with that statement, the president never, in form or substance, directed or suggested that Mr. Comey stop investigating anyone, including the president never suggested that Mr. Comey, quote, let Flynn go, close quote. As the president publicly stated the next day, he did say to Mr. Comey, quote, General Flynn is a good guy. He has been through a lot, close quote. And also, quote, asked how General Flynn is doing, close quote. Admiral Rogers testified today that the president never, quote, directed him to do anything illegal, immoral, unethical, or inappropriate, close quote, and never, never, quote, pressured him to do so, close quote. Director Coates said the same thing. The president likewise never pressured Mr. Comey. The president also never told Mr. Comey, quote, I need loyalty. I expect loyalty, close quote. He never said it in form, and he never said it in substance. Of course, The office of the president is entitled to expect loyalty from those who are serving the administration. And from before this president, took office to this day, it is overwhelmingly clear that there have been and continue to be those in government who are actively attempting to undermine this administration with selective and illegal leaks of classified information and privileged communications. Mr. Comey has now admitted that he is one of these leakers. Today, Mr. Comey admitted that he unilaterally and surreptitiously made unauthorized disclosures to the press of privileged communications with the president. The leaks of this privileged information began no later than March 2017, when friends of Mr. Comey have stated that he disclosed to them the conversations that he had with the president during their January 27th, 2017 dinner and February 14th, 2017 White House meeting. Today, Mr. Comey admitted that he leaked to friends of his purported memos of those privileged communications, one of which he testified was classified. Mr. Comey also testified that immediately after he was terminated, he authorized his friends to leak the contents of those memos to the press in order to, in Mr. Comey's words, quote, prompt the appointment of a special counsel, close quote. Although Mr. Comey testified that he only leaked the memos in response to a tweet, the public record reveals that the New York Times was quoting from those memos the day before the referenced tweet, which belies Mr. Comey's excuse for this unauthorized disclosure of privileged information and appears to be entirely retaliatory. We will leave it to the appropriate authorities to determine whether these leaks should be investigated along with all the others that are being investigated. In sum, it is now established that the president was not being investigated for colluding with or attempting to obstruct any investigation. As the committee pointed out today, these important facts for the country to know are virtually the only facts that have not been leaked during the course of these events. As he said yesterday, the president feels completely vindicated and is eager to continue moving forward with his agenda, with the business of this country, and with this public cloud removed. Thank you.
As Mark Kasowitz, who is the president's personal attorney, speaking at the National Press Club, responding to the testimony by fired FBI Director James Comey today, he's not taking any questions there. Ron Elving?
No, it's not Ron Elving. It's Ray Graff. And welcome back to WAMC. You've just been hearing live coverage of a press conference by President Trump's outside attorney, Mark Kasowitz. And now we're back to the Science Forum. It's 800-348-2551. We heard a lot of talk about leaks from Mark Kasowitz, and you found some information, Barbara Rabbits, related to that.
Yes, there was a question before the press conference about urine.
Oh, yes.
And the smell of urine.
Uh-huh.
Back to your leak analogy.
Right.
And it turns out that the gene for that allows people to smell asparagus is in the human genome to 94% of the population.
Aha. Uh-huh.
There is a slight elite of 6% that cannot smell the nasty smell of day two asparagus.
Wow. Well, I don't know how the show could get much worse.
I don't know how I got through grad school.
Let's go over to line three and see if it can get any worse. Sandy and Oneonta. Sandy, you're on.
Okay, this compared to the Trump thing is insignificant, but okay. One thing I've tried to get an answer. I'm 80 years old, so I've had a lot of urine things on.
Okay.
But this is I've known about cloudy urine and blah blah blah. But when I go to the bathroom. The bowl is totally clear, except, well, I mean, except for regular. No, it's clear, actually.
Yeah, let's just leave
it
at that.
And down at the bottom of the bowl is really pretty, like, crystalline color yellow. Hmm. And I don't know why.
Well, can
you?
I am not a medical professional. However, I can tell you what the biochemistry most likely is.
Okay.
And that is there are crystals that are formed in urine that can potentially create kidney stones.
Mm-hmm.
So there's three real types, but the most common one creates kind of star-like shapes. And the problem with kidney stones that are made out of these star-like shapes, and I'm not saying you have a kidney stone, but just let me go there.
All right.
Is that they're really prickly. They're kind of like molecular burrs. And so as they travel from the kidney to the bladder, they go through a little tube called the ureter, and they kind of scratch the heck out of the inside of this tube, which can lead to infection and pain, and obviously they can get stuck. You may have a slight propensity to make crystals in your urine, and they're getting through without damaging your ureter. They're not creating stones in either your kidney or your bladder that you know of, but you're still excreting them.
There's absolutely no pain.
Great, terrific. But you are excreting them to the point where when they come out and the pH changes, that they form crystals spontaneously.
Still, she may want to go consult with a doctor.
I would, I would. And I also would continue to drink lots of water because dilution is the solution. It's the way that you don't allow stones to form.
Well, and the question I have for you is, do you drink lots of tea?
Tea is one of those that can push you towards stones, type of the crystals.
Yes. So. In fact, when I was in China a number of years ago, because I had to drink lots of water, and it was China, so I had lots of tea, I developed these type of kidney stones.
Oh, I'll be darned.
Oxalic acid.
Right. And there's struvites and there's hippuric acid. There's three types.
What a show. It's just about 2:39, and I swear we've entered the twilight zone here. It's the Science Forum.
We're there with you.
Number to call is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. Or you can email voxpop@wamc.org. With the president's attorney now dispensed with, we'll get on with the home stretch of the program.
Support comes from Love Apple Farm, Route 9H, Ghent, New York, an 80-acre orchard, family petting zoo, playground, and fruit picking, authentic Mexican lunch, cider donuts, fresh food market, and bakery. 518-828-5048. The Wild Center, Tupper Lake, New York, now presenting the Wild Walk, an aerial pathway providing scenic views and nature experiences. Wildcenter.org for details. Quality Foreign Car Care, Ballston Spa, New York, specializing in European car sales and service for over 20 years, QFCC.com. Real Seafood Company, Wolf Road Colony, locally owned seafood restaurant and raw bar, realseafoodco.com. And Ashfield Stone, Shelburne Falls, Massachusetts, quarry and fabrication used for enduring landscapes and interiors, including countertops and floor planking. Rare and wonderful native stone of the Berkshires, ashfieldstone.com.
Welcome back to Radio Gold here. It's the Science Forum on WAMC, 800-348-2551, the telephone number. Barbara Brabitz, Jim Pickett, Ed Stander. They're the panel of experts. Ray Graff, your humble host here. This one came in via email at voxpopwamc.org. It's from Mark. It says, good afternoon. We'll say good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
The cartoons that we grew up watching used to always make it seem like bulls can be provoked by the color red. Is it really dangerous to wear the color red around a bull? And if so, why does this color bother the bull?
They're all looking at me like I'm the red bull expert.
There's a lot of bull to go around.
I would be surprised if the bull can actually distinguish red in that there are relatively few mammals, the primates being an exception, that have full color vision.
But you don't know this for sure.
I don't know that for sure.
Well, if you think about camouflage.
Yeah.
camo clothes. One of the colors of bright camo that are out there are the orange camo outfits.
Mm-hmm.
And the reasons why is that we can distinguish that orange, but to a deer, it does not. It looks the same as the brown camo because they have the inability to distinguish between the reds and the browns. So I concur. If I were to guess, and this is purely speculation, that the red is only going to appear like a vibrant brown to a bull.
Oh, okay.
I think it's more conditioning. These bulls are. It's not a spontaneous thing that they come to fight. They're conditioned to train. And, you know, there's a lot of pain and reinforcement that goes with that.
All right. Well, that was a pleasant diversion. But now let's get back to the urine questions. 800-348-2551. It's a science forum. Howard in New Paltz. Howard, you're on.
Yeah, hi. I know you've heard this before from me, but I have a lot of problems when I eat dairy products. It creates frequent urination and the prostate gets a little
yeah.
bit.
Yeah. You know, it's not Medical Monday, Howard. I'm just saying. Well, we can...
No, I know, but it's still science, right?
Well, okay.
Biology, science, whatever you want to call it.
You make a valid point. All right, go ahead.
Yeah. Okay. So basically, I want to know if they have heard of this before. Hmm.
Dairy products causing frequent urination and prostate issues.
I have not heard that.
Yeah, in men, of course. Women don't have prostate.
Right, you are, Howard.
Howard, I haven't heard it directly as a phenomenon, but I can help you wrap your head around it. Dairy products are high in protein. How much dairy product are we talking about? Do you drink one or two glasses of milk a day? Is it a Greek
yogurt
thing?
Well, I don't drink milk, but I eat cheese occasionally. And
okay, all right.
When I do eat it, it could be like three slices of cheese. I'll definitely feel it, like within an hour or two after.
Right, yeah. And cheese is kind of concentrated milk, right? Simplistic viewpoint. So not only are you eating dairy product, but you're eating kind of like the industrial strength dairy product.
Yeah.
High protein.
Right. And therefore, you do have a high protein load that you're taking with it. And again, back to my original explanation of what the kidney does and how urine and specifically urea is produced, the nitrogenous waste, the nitrogen-containing waste that comes from protein is dangerous for us to build up. It can actually cause a toxicity. It can cause like a drunkenness that happens if you have too much. And if you've known anyone who's been on kidney dialysis, you can tell it's time for them to be dialyzed because they get a little furry in their head. Anyway, back to the nitrogen. You got to get it out. So your body has to expend significant energy. It is not a free ride to get this stuff out. And so I am not surprised that you have more frequent urination, especially if your kidneys have lost some function over the years. So there you go. They may not be as efficient a sieve as they used to be. So they have to sieve it a couple of times to get it all out.
And again, drinking more water makes that less of a problem.
Howard, great question. Thanks very much. It's the Science Forum on WAMC. Ray Graff here along with Jim Pickett and Ed Stander and Barbara Brabitz and, of course, Alan in Williamstown. Alan, you're on.
Yes, hi. Going back to urine, this is not the most pleasant question, but I am told that I have heard of people lost in a boat in the ocean and they have survived by drinking urine.
My career has now come to an end. I'm leaving.
It's better than salt water, so I'm told.
It's better than salt water. Wah, wah, wah.
But it's not good because basically you're drinking all the water to make urine to get rid of all that stuff that's in the bloodstream.
You're kind of kicking the can down the road a little, but when you get to the end of the road, it's going to be a much steeper cliff.
Right.
Yeah. In fact,
but if you're in a boat for a little while, why are we even asking this?
Poor Ray.
But if you're in a boat for a while, I mean, does it make practical sense? Do you know to have a
swig? There's actually a better way to do it, and that would be as an enema. But there you go. I'm done.
The stories were people who were basically lost at sea, and that's how they survived.
Not for long.
A day or two. That's it.
So this is like Gilligan's Island, the untold story?
Yeah, it's the nasty part of Gilligan's Island.
Well, I've had about enough. Alan, thank you very much. 800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum. And good heavens to Murgatroyd. Give me something else.
Where are the flowers and the bees and
Paul in Scotia, please, if you say the word urine, I am going to explode. So just say something else. Paul, you're on.
I'm not interested in bodily functions, actually.
God bless you.
My question regards, regards gravity. Everybody knows that, you know, energy and electrons, photons travel at the speed of light, but nobody ever talks about how fast gravity travels. In other words, if a large body, say like the moon, suddenly disappeared, how long would it take for the effects of its missing gravity to be felt on the Earth?
1.5 seconds.
Really?
Because it travels at the gravity travels at the speed of light.
That's
something which actually hadn't been proved for a very long time.
Did they prove it recently?
But it's proved now.
Gravity waves?
Gravity waves travel at the speed of light.
Have they detected more than one? I know
they detected them recently.
They're
at three now.
Really?
Three. There was just one a couple weeks ago.
Yep.
And tell us how they did that. There are widely spaced tubes, right,
yes,
that are at right angles, am I correct?
Essentially two tubes that are each a couple miles long.
Mm-hmm.
At right angles to each other.
With a light running through them.
With a light running through them. And when to make a long story short, when a big gravity wave comes through, one tube gets a little bit longer than the other tube, and that can be detected. And it is just an unbelievable feat of metrology, of measuring things, to be able to detect this extremely small difference.
But for this to work, there have to be two sets of these widely separated, correct?
In order to have the reason that you need at least two is because there's a lot of noise. And if you see a signal, you want that corroborated by somebody else seeing the same signal. And you need at least two to have some idea of the direction. And with three, then it can be triangulated, like finding the epicenter of an earthquake.
But how do you prove that it moved at the speed of light?
I don't know the specifics of that,
yeah,
but it has been proved that gravity works at the speed of light.
But do we know what gravity is? We now know there is a wave function of gravity, but do we know what gravity is?
Where's
the physicist?
Well, the basic idea from Einstein is that gravity is a distortion of space-time due to weight, due to mass. If you have the way I do it in class is I take a big rubber sheet and I put a bowling ball in the center, and effectively it's the change in that form. And that's in two dimensions,
okay,
to get the idea. So if you remove that weight, the idea is that the return to a flat surface, if you will, is nearly instantaneous. It's at the speed of light. That would be the argument, that it's at the speed of
and
light.
And that's the wave.
Right.
So where did the bowling ball go?
Well, you get rid of the bowling ball by whatever fashion.
That's the chemist in me. You can't just get rid of matter instantaneously. There's always a timeline of matter dissipating and becoming energy.
Yeah.
And so it's all a theoretical right now that we're going to blink our I Dream of Genie eyeballs and make them go away.
Yeah.
But it doesn't, matter doesn't dissipate like that.
Yeah, and even if you turn the matter into energy, that still acts
still change
on, like gravity.
Yes. Yeah.
All right, let's go back to the phones here, 800-348-2551. Go ahead.
I just should mention that if you know where the gravity wave is coming from, for example, if there's a stellar explosion someplace off in space, that light reaches at a certain point. If the gravity wave reaches at the same moment, then you can argue that it moved at the speed of light.
The same moment that we can see the event.
That we can see the effect.
Have they confirmed such a thing?
Well, that would be the way that I would do it if I were a scientist, which I am, but I don't have the equipment.
Okay, let's go to line one, and Ryan in Steventown. Ryan, you're on.
Oh, hello.
Hello.
I have a question about stars.
Ah.
Well,
go for
it. Stars like our...
Go ahead.
Small stars like our sun will eventually collapse into a white dwarf, which are still supported by atoms as we know them.
Mm-hmm.
But then larger stars, the atoms collapse into neutrons to form neutron stars.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also, when larger stars collapse, when they form iron, they'll be able to explode into a supernova. My question is, are these the same mass limit? Like, when a star is large enough to create a supernova, is that automatically large enough to leave a neutron star, or different point.
Yes. In order for a star to collapse far enough to produce iron, effectively that occurs during the supernova phase, which means that the star would have to be greater than about 8 solar masses of our sun. So if it is above 8 solar masses to whatever, effectively, it will produce either a neutron star or a black hole. But the gases that come out from the outside of that would be producing iron, would have iron in their structure.
So, Ed, to okay. kind of extrapolate his question, our sun is a second-generation sun because it has stuff. We have stuff heavier than iron.
That's
nearby.
Correct.
So,
or third generation or fourth.
Right, more than first generation. So was the first sun in the region that our second or third or fourth sun is now, or are we kind of distantly related and there was just a congealing of the material that it left behind?
Well, we have been looking for these primary stars, first-generation stars, for a very long time. And the way you would tell a first-generation star is that it doesn't contain iron or any of these heavier elements. Mm-hmm. It's mostly lithium, hydrogen, and helium. Yep. We haven't found them. But the trick is that a star that would contain only those three elements would be very, very, very big in order to have enough gravity to stay together. So when it collapsed, it would form heavier elements. It would form carbon and oxygen and such, but it wouldn't get to iron. But that material would then make a heavier star, which would then be able to collapse further. So it's a continuum that produces that finally gets to the point where a supernova can be produced.
So we can only really speculate how much of a reach or how far distant the primary star was versus where a second-generation, third-generation star would be.
Can't tell.
All right. Over to David in Rensselaerville. David, you're on.
Yes, I was wondering if there's any truth to the fact that claims that certain spots on Earth have less gravitational pull than others, such as Sedona in Arizona.
Oh, yes. There are maps of the gravity, Bouguer anomalies, where they have gone across the entire Earth with magnetometers and with gravitometers. And there are places with more gravity and less. Depends on what the structure of the Earth underneath that point is.
Is there any pattern?
Oh, yeah. Mountains are usually heavier. And the reason they have higher gravity is because they're thicker. They go down into the mantle.
Is it perceptible for a human being to be? I mean, do you feel lighter or in certain places than others?
No, we're talking about milligals. We're talking about very, very small changes.
Yeah. How sensitive would a person have to be? I mean, in other words, are there people who are more sensitive to gravity than others?
Well, how do you differentiate gravity from magnetism at this point? Because magnetism is a force that I think we all agree we can feel much more, and certainly we've proven that animals are driven by magnetic poles and magnetic anomalies. So, you know, how could you get such a small signal when this other overwhelming signal is pretty much running in the same direction?
How do they map thank you, David, for that question. How do they map the
You can
the
do
gravity?
It, for example, with satellites. As a satellite goes over a heavier object, it'll speed up and then slow down. That's how, for example, they figured out the gravity of Venus. They used the Magellan probe, and they got it close enough to the planet that as it sped up or slowed down, they were able to figure out the gravity data.
Yeah, but these obviously are very small
very
effects.
Small.
They're hard to measure.
Mm-hmm.
And you would not be able to walk around from place to place and feel a difference in the gravity.
What about insects?
Probably not either. Okay. Although I am convinced that the gravity is stronger under the scale in my doctor's office.
Aha! Well played, Mr. Pickett. This one came in via email from Kathleen. My mother and her four sisters, all born in early 1900s, all had the flu during the epidemic in 1918 and all lost their sense of smell. Mm-hmm. They blamed the flu. What do you think? And that's from Kathleen.
Agreed.
Yep.
What about the flu would cause you to lose your sense of smell?
It's a respiratory illness. And if you have enough infection, and Spanish flu was
pretty bad.
Really, yes, you know, it's, you know, we've characterized that flu and looked at the generations of flus, like you never get the same flu twice. So the generations of flu in the intervening 100 years, And it was really virulent, and it was really strong, and it was also very contagious. So that was the combination that really creates the pandemic that it was. But if you have a respiratory virus, all you need to do is damage the optic nerve or damage the ends of the brain that receive the signal from the optic nerve, and either one could have happened.
The optic nerve affects sense of smell?
Otic nerve, the smell nerves.
I got
you. Olfactory nerves.
Yep.
All right, very quickly, let's go over to line four. And Dorian Schenectady, you have about 20 seconds.
I was simply going to add that regarding the bulls and what causes them to charge, a supposition that they're colorblind is correct, but it's also that known that they are notoriously poor-sighted. Mm-hmm. So in addition to colorblindness and conditioning, it's also thought that the movement of the cape creates the impression on them that they're under attack. And it's one of the reasons that when you're working with the animals, you're always approaching from the side.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense because they're prey.
Well, Dory, thank you for that one. That will be the last question today in what has been truly epic radio.
Extraordinary.
Wow. And that's what public radio is all about, people. And thank you for all your pledges during the fund drive. We endeavor to keep this sort of thing going.
Well, I'm glad it's over. I've got to go to the bathroom.
Ed Stender, thank you for being here. Jim Pickett, Barbara Brabich, thank you all. Support comes from Identity Eyewear, Albany, New York, specializing in distinctive eyewear featuring new styles for 2017. Eye exams by appointment, 518-459-2638. Stavros, helping people with disabilities achieve their dreams. Offices in Amherst, Greenfield, and Springfield. Stavros.org for more information. The Hyde Collection, an art museum and historic house in Glens Falls, New York. Open Tuesday through Saturday, 10 to 5, and Sunday, 12 to 5. HydeCollection.org. At Whitney's Farm Market and Country Gardens, Cheshire. Featuring We Plan, You Plant garden design service with on-site selection of nursery stock, tree, shrub, perennial garden, privacy hedges installation, whitneysfarm.com. Thanks again to our scientists, and thanks to you for listening and for the, for the interesting calls today. Zach Malloy was our engineer. Deb Malik took your calls. Our producer is Jim Lavoulis. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, cookbook author Bruce Weinstein will be in the house to debunk some cooking myths. Right now, though, stand by for news.